Human beings can't survive long without water, but you notice that they have bunches of ways they choose to hydrate. Water is the basis for all our other beverages, and plenty of people like a beer now and then. Both the beer and wine industries have grown in our region in recent years. Our guest this hour sticks with beer and gives us a history story that's really two stories from the mid-19th and late 20th centuries. Phil Bussey is the author of Southern Oregon Beer, A Pioneering History. Phil is the publisher and editor of the Rogue Valley Messenger. It is the latest in a series of papers he's worked on, which include the Portland Mercury and the Eugene Weekly. Phil is also the executive director of the Media Institute for Social Change. Phil Bussey, thanks for joining us.
Absolutely. How are you this morning?
I'm doing well. Thank you. Before we get into the beer, please tell us about MediaMakingChange.org.
Certainly. So I started a nonprofit about 10 years ago. You know, I wanted to run a camp that taught college students how to make documentaries about social issues. And we have hosted it for 10 years, and students learn journalistic skills and storytelling skills, and they make short radio and film documentaries about social issues and try to affect positive change. It's really heartening to see the passion that college students have and to provide them tools, media tools, to make their statements. So it's been a really fun experience.
It sounds cool. We'll put a link to that on our website with the story about beer. Now we've done the work. Now let's have a beer. Does your interest in beer have anything to do with being raised in Wisconsin, Phil?
it does to some extent. Yes, I grew up, and my grandparents lived in Milwaukee, and it was strange, you know, in the late 70s going there, and you could smell, I mean, you could just smell the yeast in the air from Miller. You know, and of course, my baseball team are the Milwaukee Brewers, named after that.
Playing at Miller Park.
Miller Park, absolutely, which is always funny that they call it a local beer.
Right.
And they serve local hot dogs, Oscar Mayer Wieners. not quite the right spirit of locally produced, but the idea. But it was strange. Growing up, I did not know about the 48ers. Not to be confused with the 49ers, which are, of course, the gold rush. But the 48ers were Germans that were coming to America in the mid-19th century and just made an enormous impact on culture. And one of the most measurable ways that they did that was changing drinking habits from Americans were drinking whiskey before then, and then after that, really, beer became the predominant beverage. And, you know, and these are names that we all know now. Miller, like we said, Einheiser, Busch, Leinenkugel, Coors. These were all German immigrants who arrived in America in the mid-19th centuries. They were fleeing a failed social revolution and coming to America to make their mark. And a lot of them ended up in Milwaukee and St. Louis. But also a lot of them came to gold rush towns to find their fortune. And, you know, one of those towns is Golden, Colorado, which was Coors. And another one of those towns was Jacksonville, Oregon. And at the time was a really bustling, big, wealthy city. And quite a few Germans showed up there, and a couple of them started breweries.
And the first of these is the first guy we meet in chapter one is it Veit Schultz? Schutz?
You know, I say Veit Schultz, mm-hmm. but I've heard other pronunciations, yes. Such a great character, you know, I mean, very likable, in terms of wanting to contribute to the town and public interest, opens up a brewery that also has on the second floor, a gymnasium, a roller rink. He hosts social events. He's in the town marching band. But at the same time, he's also just, not likable. He's a brawler. You know, he picks fights. There's fights at the brewery.
Banty Rooster, was that one of the names attached to him?
Yeah, people called him a Bantam Rooster. I mean, he was a lot of the historic records I found out really pointed out how short he was, and it seemed to affect his personality to some extent. So he certainly tried to prove himself, but he built Southern Oregon's largest brewery at the time. And, you know, really was a focal point for Jacksonville culture.
So the opening of the brewery really was a confirmation that Jacksonville was for real, wasn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, so I've written, I like beer, you know, but I've never really thought of it as something academic, you know, until I start writing reviews, and then I was asked a year ago to write this book. And one of the first things that struck me was, you know, why does it matter that, why does the history of breweries matter? And really, breweries can be a metric, like you were just saying, for people's optimism in a town. You know, because before that, it was really Jacksonville was dirt roads and, you know, not much more than tents at the time. And there were certainly saloons where people would pour whiskey. But to start a brewery meant that you believed the town would be around for a number of years, because to get the materials there, to get the copper kettles, to get the hops, the wheat, the barley, was really a huge undertaking.
By mule train in the 1850s, right?
By mule train, you know, by cart, by, you know, walking. You know, so these are, if you think about a nice metric, I think, is to think about, it cost about $1 just to get a piece of mail out of Jacksonville, which would be the equivalent of about $20 today. A pound of flour was about $8 then, which would be close to about $100 now. And so think about it, like just those necessities, and then you get into things that are more of a luxury, like hops and wheat. It must have been such an undertaking and just so ambitious to do that. And you're not going to put that kind of money into an endeavor if you think that the town's going to fold in 6 months. So people really believed in Jacksonville at the time. And
the brewery was certainly proof. So we'll pick up the story on the other side of a break. The book is called Southern Oregon Beer, A Pioneering History. Phil Bussey of the Rogue Valley Messenger, the author of the book. We'll come back and talk more with Phil and take phone calls and emails from you in a minute five. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Phil Bussey, who is the publisher and editor of the Rogue Valley Messenger, but an author at some greater length in a book called Southern Oregon Beer, A Pioneering History, which really traces essentially two births and growths of the Southern Oregon beer business in time, one in the middle of the 19th century and one much later in the 20th century. You can join the conversation on the exchange as we talk about beer and who brought it to the region. And 800-838-3760 is that phone number. Our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. So this is the History Press, which is basically the same company as Arcadia Publishing, which puts out all the books about small towns. So the publisher approached you about this book, I understand, Phil, and you nixed it at first?
Right. You know, at first I got an email, and then we talked on the phone. They asked to write this because I've written some beer reviews, and I just thought it was a silly idea. I thought to write a history of beer just didn't sound all that important. But I asked for, you know, 24 hours, and I did some research, and I found that actually beer and breweries is a great way to talk about history, especially for Southern Oregon. Just the timing of everything with German immigrants arriving in America, really at the same time that Oregon was being settled by Europeans, and then the changes that the railroads brought about and how that affected the local economies in Grants Pass and established Medford, you know, those were really interesting ways, and beer and breweries were a great way to talk about those. So I said, yeah, you know, I'll check this out, and I'm so glad I did. It really was a fun book to research, and, you know, and I think a good story to tell. It helps tell the shape of history in Southern Oregon, and not just the past, but the current history.
Right, because as I pointed out, there's really two histories of beer in Southern Oregon, and we'll get to both in this hour. You mentioned, though, that a lot of people before the Germans arrived, in the 48ers arrived, fleeing Germany and a failed revolution there, that the taste was really for whiskey and some other stuff, and it turned to beer. How heavily did it turn to beer by the second half of the 19th century?
Oh, boy, you know, it went from really beer as, you know, an afterthought or something that was maybe being drunk in New York and Philadelphia with English ales to about quadrupled the drinking, you know, and just it became what people were drinking. And, you know, at first there was, maybe 400 breweries in America in the mid-19th century. And by the time, towards the end of the 19th century, we're talking 4,000 breweries, which every little town had its own brewery. You know, Jacksonville, Grants Pass, Medford, each town had its own brewery. And that was something that was happening across America. And what I find remarkable is that number in the 1870s of 4,000 breweries is a number that wasn't matched again until just 2010, 2015. You know, and I think that's really fun fact to think about, is this local economy was something that was happening in the late 19th century and is something that we're returning to. I find a lot of optimism in those numbers.
Let's come back to some of the early brewers in Jacksonville, because there's another name in addition to Veet Schutz, which is Joseph Vetterer. Tell us about him.
Yeah, sure, absolutely. So Joseph Vetterer, he's another German that arrives also in Jacksonville hoping to, you know, make his money from gold and ends up becoming a brewer. And he, along with his wife, run another brewery, not as rambunctious as Veet Schutz's brewery, which is if people are familiar with Jacksonville, is right down the hill from the Brick Gardens. Vetterer's brewery is up on Oregon Street and still stands today. And he opened up a brewery. His wife outlives him, and which is fairly interesting in terms of she and a couple other women are actually owning and running the breweries in Southern Oregon in the 1870s. This is such a male-dominated industry, yet in the late 19th century, about half the breweries are owned and run by women.
It's a really interesting picture you provide in the book of after Vetterer died and his wife was running the brewery, she just finally took to crossing his name out on documents.
She was great. I mean, she, again, just like Veet Schutz was a wonderful character because he was so rambunctious, she was a wonderful person to research because she was so meticulous. She kept amazing records. And Oregon State actually has a full-time archivist for beer and hops and had files of her receipts that she kept. You know, handwritten notes from Henry Weinhardt, the actual Henry Weinhardt, receipts from places in San Francisco where she bought her supplies, from hops growers around Roseburg and the Willamette Valley. So through her, it's really a fun to put together all these puzzle pieces, and you can start to see that she really had this web of commerce of bringing in wheat from Eastern Oregon, hops from the Willamette Valley, supplies up from San Francisco. She was great, you know, in terms of being, she was a researcher's dream.
Right. Oh, because she kept so much stuff. Yeah, so meticulous with her record keeping. So another name among the women brewers in the region, Marie, is it Keeneland and Grants Pass?
That's what I say as well, Keeneland, yes.
And
she is, you know, as much as Frederica Vetterer was, you know, stout German, Marie was a somewhat wild, zany French woman. And she arrives in Grants Pass with a man who may or may not have been her husband, who was certainly somebody else's husband, and she had absconded from St. Paul, Minnesota with, and she sets up, they buy a brewery in Grants Pass, and that brewery eventually burns down, as buildings did in the 19th century, and they rebuilt a brick brewery, which stands today. That's the Climate City Brewery, and she built that brewery. She was notorious, I would say, for two things. One, walking around Grants Pass with parrots on her shoulders, mm-hmm. and the other was that they would sell buckets of beer for a quarter. And there was an article I was able to find that interviewed a 90-year-old man this is about 20 years ago. So he was a kid during this time, and he remembered going, he remembered the parrots. He remembered going and buying buckets of beer for a quarter and taking them home to his dad. I mean, I guess, you know, maybe it's not that strange. Maybe that's the turn-of-the-century version of a growler, right?
Right. Oh, man, that's amazing. So another woman who added some color to the beer business, Mary Mell. Who was she? Where did she work?
Yeah, you know, I wasn't able to find as much about Mary. She married a brewer, and this guy is another German, Gottlieb Mell, and he was sort of the Johnny Appleseed of breweries. He started one in Roseburg. He started one in Oakland, Oregon, and then went out to the coast and started one. And again, was outlived by his wife, and she clearly had picked up ideas about the business and ran a couple breweries out there for a number of years. But there's just not as much information about her. They're just the records were much more thin there. And, you know, that's something, I'm a journalist. That's my trade. And most of what I do is, you know, I interview people and I look at contemporary documents. So this was a new exercise for me to really dig around to the 19th century. And it was a lot like being a detective. I mean, I think it tapped into this like boyhood dream I had of being one of the Hardy Boys.
Right, right. Yeah, yeah. It's a paper trail you're searching, but not for somebody who's alive now. It's trying to find the record of something that happened long ago.
And you can't always find the right facts, you know. So like Viet Schütz, even his obituary, which would have been the most contemporary piece of evidence for him, listed his age as, quote, presumably 83. I mean, it's amazing to think. And Marie, the woman with the parrots on her shoulders, her age was all over the place. On the census, the 1900 census, it's listed as older than her husband, yet in other places she's listed as younger than her husband. It was difficult to pin down the details. And I try to include that in the book, because I found that really fun to not be able to pinpoint things, but to understand that there is a mystery here.
Indeed, there is. The book is called Southern Oregon Beer, A Pioneering History. Our guest is Phil Bussey, telling us about the growth of the beer industry. At the moment, we've been dealing with the middle of the 19th century, but there's another growth of the beer industry late in the 20th century that we have yet to discuss as well. You're welcome to join the discussion. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email. It's jx@jeffnet.org. Here's a call from Jacob in Springfield. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Phil Bussey.
Hi. I wanted to point out the history an evolution of human beings with alcohol. But for 99% of human history, drinking water was actually kind of dangerous, risky, especially when humans got into groups of, you know, tribes and proto-cities, when people got together and concentrated, you know, small cities and towns. Mm-hmm. They shared germs, and every time you drank water, you know, you risk getting typhus or dysentery or diarrhea illnesses. It was particularly worse for the small children, you know. So there was two ways to treat bacteria in water. One is to boil it, and that's kind of what the Chinese did. They made tea. But the other alternative is to use chemicals in bactericidals. If you read the Bible, when Jesus went to the wedding in Canaan, they did something curious. Every time they didn't drink the water, they would dilute the water with wine, one part wine to two parts water, and they drink that. And that was sort of the infrastructure for all water, that you drank water that was partially diluted with beer or mead or wine to kill the bacteria, and then everyone drank it, including pregnant women and children. But it, one, provided clean water or cleaner water, and two, sustenance, because everyone was kind of short on calories.
Oh, right, yeah, you get your carbs with the
calories
beer.
And getting, you know, calories through the months. And it also, the other effect was it kind of made everyone a little drunk and a little happy. But we know that people drink alcohol for the first time and say it completes us, because you've evolved to have this enzyme that breaks down that alcohol, and for you to deal with that alcohol and not be alcoholic some extent, because a little bit of alcohol was actually, you know, useful for health and the development of civilization.
All right, Jacob, thanks for the story. Very much appreciate that. So, Phil, how does this square with what you found out about the rationale that people made before Prohibition about drinking beer?
Yeah, you know, I didn't get so much into that far back of history. You know, I really picked it up with the Germans arriving. But that idea of clean water definitely does drive where some of the breweries end up. And, you know, I think that going back to the Grants Pass Brewery, if anyone visits Climate City and Brewery in Grants Pass, you'll notice there's a little stream that goes by. And that's exactly why the brewery was located there, because they were always looking for quote-unquote artisan water. You know, they need a good, clean water. You know, whereas a brewery in Medford wanted to situate itself near the railway line because that gave them the opportunity for distribution and for easier access to ingredients. The problem was that going for the railway line didn't necessarily mean that you'd find water. And that was a fun story to research, as these guys spent months digging a well. And, I mean, they were at about 300 feet deep. There was a nice article about a guy who lost a few fingers because they're digging. So that idea of where the water and clean water was coming from, you know, really does drive some of the geography of all of this.
So let's talk about the railroad, though, in a different context, because railroads did come late to Southern Oregon. I mean, we're talking about the railroad getting to Medford in the late 1880s. That's like 25 years after most of the rest of the country had it. Did the isolation then help the breweries here? I mean, it was hard to get supplies here, but did it kind of protect them from competition?
It did, you know, and I think it was really interesting. I mean, in a way, it's sort of like the Southern Oregon was like the Galapagos Islands, right? I mean, it was isolated from what was happening with the rest of the country of being connected. That said, Anheuser and Busch, a father-in-law and a son, German immigrants again, out of St. Louis, they really helped pioneer this idea of refrigerated boxcars. And they start the product Budweiser, which becomes one of the first national products. That really impacted the economy and of local brewers. That idea of, you know, a need for a brewery in every town. Like you just said, though, Southern Oregon was isolated from that, so really made an interesting case study. But once the railroad does come through, there's an immediate change. And, again, if there's a nice graph in the book that shows this plummet from high point of 4,000 breweries around the country to about half of that 10 years later. And that's because the railroad shows up and that need for local economies is wiped out. And there's obviously, you know, parallels to today with Amazon and with online ordering, which I find really interesting.
Right. I'm looking at the graph right now. That is quite a steep decline. The nice thing to know is that there are actually more breweries now than there were in the beginning of the scale, whatever year that is. It's pretty small in the book. We're talking again with Phil Bussey about his book, Southern Oregon Beer, A Pioneering History. The story of the well, was that Southern Oregon Brewery or SOB?
Yes. Yeah. And it's such a, the Medford Brewery from about 1900 to, it's one of the few breweries that actually reopens after Prohibition. It goes through a number of names. So it is called Southern Oregon Brewery, then it's called the Medford Brewery, then it's A1 Brewery. It goes through a number of names as it tries to find its footing and last. SOB Brewery then is a brewery that reopens in 2000, 2005 in Medford again. So it's had a really fun history, and it seems to keep popping up in Medford's history.
So the kinds of beer, I haven't asked about that yet, made in the local breweries in the mid to late 19th century, were these ales, were they lagers, a combination of things?
They were lagers, and you know, and that actually that's something that I learned through the research. Like, that's a very big difference. So ales really were the British style ales, and that's part of the reason that in the early 19th century they weren't that popular, because ales are tricky to make. They can sour really quickly. They're not as stable, whereas lagers were something that the Germans brought with them, and they had a much more stability, and could be stored for longer and just were cleaner looking and were more appealing. So the beers that were being made in the late 19th century were primarily were lagers. That's what the Germans were interested in, and you know, 80-90% of the brewers in the 19th century were German. But we shouldn't be thinking about, you know, hops and these triple dry hopped IPAs and what have you that are popular today. That's not something that was happening back then. And, you know, I could look at some of the purchase records and see the quantity that was being made and the number of hops, the poundage of hops that were being brought in. So the beers were far less hoppy than they are today.
Well, you really did assemble a puzzle picture. The book is called Southern Oregon Beer, A Pioneering History. Phil Bussey, the publisher and editor of the Rogue Valley Messenger, is the author of the book and our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. There's a foreword from the founder of Caldera Brewing. We'll talk more about the process of making the book and all the things he found out when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 15. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest is enjoying a beer break with us here. His book is about Southern Oregon beer, A Pioneering History, a look at what happened when beer arrived in the region in the mid-1800s with the German immigrants who came to the region, to Jacksonville specifically, and how it expanded from there. And then, of course, the second big boom in beer in the late 20th century, all covered in the book. You can join us on the exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So as we've learned from discussions about the wine industry as well, that obviously there's a long dry period, literally, because of Prohibition. But now, here we got to talk about the fixation that we have with the national number in 1918, but in fact, it arrived earlier in Southern Oregon, didn't it?
Yeah, Grants Pass in 1908, a full decade ahead of the rest of the country, voted for Prohibition. And, you know, I think that the city council at the time was really concerned that Grants Pass was becoming a pretty rowdy railroad town. You know, and part of that was this woman, Marie, that we spoke about before, with the parrots on her shoulders.
Marie Keeneland. Mm-hmm.
Buckets of beer. Grants Pass, at the time, beer sales, liquor sales were providing a lot of tax revenue. And so sort of cut off their nose to spite their face, right? So they banned the sale of alcohol and beer. And because of that, they aren't able to pave their streets for almost another full decade, which I found really interesting. It meant the end of breweries like the Grants Pass Brewery, as well as then 10 years later, the National Prohibition, which just wiped out breweries across the country. And like you said, there's 15 years dry spell, 25 years in Grants Pass, and that's a long time. You know, that's for a business, that's obviously a full generation. And so when Prohibition's lifted in 1933, not all the breweries come back. You know, we're really gone down from this high point of 4,000 to under 1,000 breweries. But the brewery in Medford does come back remarkably, and has a good 15-year run as they try to compete in what's a new landscape, which really was ruled by, you know, what we know all the way through the 70s and 1980s of the big brewers, the Anheuser-Busches, the Coors, the Millers. And during that time, this idea of the little brewery or the neighborhood brewery really became something that looked like it was going to go extinct.
Mm-hmm. So what were these local breweries doing, though, in the years of Prohibition? How did they try to convert their businesses into something else?
Sure. Well, you know, a few of them tried to bootleg a bit, and there's certainly some evidence that happened at Grants Pass. Some of them tried to recalibrate and become soda pop companies. And, you know, we have, you know, Weinhardt root beer and orange cream soda that came out of that. And that was happening as well with Grants Pass tried to do that, and Medford tried to do that. Some of them just shut down. just completely, and just you know, decided that they were going to be tilting at windmills otherwise, and just gave up the business. You know, it's which again has to have been frustrating. You've spent a lot of money, you've put a lot of investment into the building and the equipment, and to walk away from that, but that's what a number of businesses did, and you know, a lot of those buildings just stood vacant, just like the, you know, Climate City Brewery did for years, or you know, before again it was opened as first a restaurant called the Brewery, a very popular restaurant, and then more recently the Climate City Brewery. But it just shut down a segment of the economy or the industry.
So is Climate City in the place that was Marie Keeneland's brewery?
Yeah, absolutely. Wow. It's the exact same building that she built, by, you know, the brick building she built. I think it's such a wonderful return of history because, again, as I mentioned before, this is a very male-dominated industry, both the owners and the brewers. And Climate City, which had arguably the first woman brewer in Oregon, again, the brewer there is a woman, which is less than 10% of the brewers in Oregon are women. So I find that a really nice coda back to a historical point.
Truly, but you know, obviously a long valley in between those points, and with the country drinking what? Essentially Budweiser and Schlitz for 50 years?
Exactly. I mean, beer taste went, you know, to these really watered-down pilsners and to mass-produced and you know, not very interesting and not very different. You know, the return, though, came. Home brewers were sort of like these little rebel forces that were gathering in garages and basements and wanting to keep some different flavors and varieties. What you have to remember, though, is that Prohibition, even once it was lifted, it still had a long shadow that it cast, in that it banned home brewing and it banned what we now know as brew pubs. And those two prohibitions combined really did not allow for a craft beer or for the micro breweries to open up. Now, home brewing was re-allowed starting in 1979. Jimmy Carter, the president, who famously had his brother Billy Beer, he signs into law the allowance of home brewing, and that just opened up this door. So by the time Jimmy Carter leaves office, there's only 44 breweries left in America,
wow,
which is such a small number. There's about half that number just in Southern Oregon alone right now. But think about it, that's the entire country.
Wow.
And not a lot of variety happening. These home brewers are suddenly legal again, and you start to have the breweries that we now know. Rogue Brewery starts in Ashland, and a couple young brewers there spin off from there and start Caldera and Walkabout Brewery. And within 10 years of the home brewing ban being lifted, you have gone from 44 breweries to, you know, a few hundred, and 90% of those new breweries are directly coming out of home brewers that are now legal again. It's just, it's a really interesting how what seemingly could be not a major law, but a legislative change and changes something from a hobby to an industry to now a massive industry in Oregon, for sure.
It's sort of like a recreation of the original story, you know, brewing it yourself in your garage or your home, and then it becomes a more of a bigger thing at a work site.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, and it's, you know, it's fun to think about parallels. I mean, you think about the music industry. I mean, it's sort of the idea of like a garage band becoming the Beatles or the, you know, the next big band.
Mm-hmm.
You know, these are guys that are just tinkering with beer and kits that they've invented themselves, because again, home brewing was illegal, so they couldn't buy the equipment. They had to make it themselves, and suddenly they're legal, and a few of them get the idea of like, I could do something a little bit bigger. I could do something, you know, open up a little storefront with this.
Mm-hmm.
And again, that's where Caldera came out of. And Caldera is a big player regionally and, you know, increasingly potentially nationally.
Caldera broke some ground with its package sales of beer. Tell us about that.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, one of the fun things is to talk about, you know, I mean, it's easy to say pioneer when we think about 19th century and people, you know, taking the Oregon Trail and coming out of here and breaking new ground. Pioneer, though, I think can also be a term used more contemporarily. And Jim Mills, who's the brewer and the owner at Caldera, when he first started, he decided to take a gamble and to put craft beer in a can. And now that seems pretty commonplace right now, but there was only two other breweries in the country doing that. He was the first on the West Coast. And the idea was it's easier to ship. It holds the flavor better. It's like a little mini keg. It's less expensive. And it really put craft beer on the same footing as Miller and Schlitz and Coors in terms of packaging. And it has become the industry standard. So, I mean, really, it's fun to see that pioneer spirit and impact coming out of you know, what was then a small brewery in Ashland.
There's another name I want to bring in here because it's another interesting story. Nick Ellis apparently got into the brewing business because he was laid off from another job.
Right. He had been, I want to say the comptroller. He was working at Southern Oregon University, and they had had some cutbacks during an little bit of an economic downturn, and he was tinkering around, and he went over to a hobby store, the Blackbird in Medford, and just on a whim picked up a home brewing kit and tinkered around, and you know, then opened up a brewery, which has really become a very popular neighborhood brewery in Medford.
Which is his?
And again, what's that?
Which is his?
Which is his? Yeah.
I mean, which one?
Oh, Opposition.
Mm-hmm.
Opposition Brewery, you know, and again, that's that same story of that barrier to entry being removed from home brewing being allowed. It's such a great story to watch again of just somebody that just really on a weekend whim picks up a kit and that hobby becomes his industry and his life and you know, in a really important community place for quite a few people. It's such a fun place to go. It's down home. Brewery, go in. There's dartboards, there's games, there's people hanging out. I mean, it's Medford's version of Cheers.
You liked the beer before, as you pointed out. Did you gain a new respect for the brewers in the region through this research process?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I mean, I to recognize that each one of these craft breweries is really somebody's personality. Is fun to think about because it is one thing to go and explore different flavors. One of my favorite breweries, I have to say, is Portal Brewing, which is on a small corner shop in Medford. And, you know, this is a little bit older couple, and he learned to brew from his dad, and he's an old surfer. And the beers sort of reflect that. Like, they're just heavy duty. It's like what you would want on a cold, rainy Oregon coast day. And there's just so much personality coming out of a brewery like that. That idea that there's very, you know, the line between the product and the producer is so thin. I really did enjoy connecting those personalities more.
You seem to have developed some admiration too for the efforts of the brewers to engage the community in ways beyond just selling them beer.
Sure, absolutely. You know, and I think that also goes back to these, you know, this first generation of Germans, and they really came to America with the idea of setting up public spaces. So the idea of a beer garden, yes, was about drinking beer, but really was about building community. And that continues today, so that a place like Walkabout Brewery in Medford that has an outdoor space with a fire pit, and they have yoga that they host there, and they have little concerts that they host there, and, you know, really tries to create this space so that you're not, you know, it's not something that you're doing alone, but you are going in and you're meeting friends and you're hanging out and you're connecting. I think that's so important, and that idea of having the small brewery and the neighborhood brewery is something that is really very strong in Southern Oregon, you know, and it's the difference between, you know, I mean, buying a case of Budweiser and, you know, drinking it at home with your friends or going out to a brew pub and hanging out. I think that there's a really qualitative difference and an important difference in terms of how we interact as neighbors and residents.
So there's been a boom, obviously. Has there been a bit of a bust too? Did the Great Recession wipe out some of these local brewers?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think any industry goes through its ebbs and flows. As I think we're in a very interesting time right now, as the breweries, we're reaching a little bit of a saturation point, perhaps. There's only so much beer that we can or should,
right,
that our livers should absorb. I think it's even from 5 years ago to try to open up a brewery would be much more difficult right now. The materials are accessible, the knowledge is accessible, but maybe the audience isn't quite there as much. So yeah, there has been some boom or bust. And I mean, that said, new breweries are still opening up, and very good breweries are still opening up. And I think that within the industry, people think it's going to slow down a bit, but at the same time, the numbers aren't quite showing that just yet.
All right, but at least in the case of beer in the region, lightning strikes twice in the mid 1800s and in the late 1900s. Phil Bussey is the author of Southern Oregon Beer: A Pioneering History. He's the publisher and editor of the Rogue Valley Messenger and the executive director of the Media Institute for Social Change. Phil, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for the interest.
It's been a pleasure. That will do it for today's exchange. We are online at jeffexchange.org. Our producers, John Baxter and Angela Decker of JPR News. Our student assistant from Southern Oregon University, Randy Babbitt, at the controls today. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Please join us next time and have a great day.